which means assuming single point grounding, if we operate with a 1/3 neutral, that drops from 762 to 694. The drop is quite a bit more for space cables, and as I say, we have that data, and I'll show it to you in a minute. Can I have the next slide, please? Here's a typical printout of a duct installation. This is, again, 35 kV. I might point out, I'm just showing you charts for 35 kV. We have charts in the report at 15. Generally, the ampacities for the 15 kV cable are slightly higher, possibly up to 5% as compared to the 35 kV cables, except for larger conductor sizes with large neutrals, in which case they are equal or very slightly lower. And this is, of course, due to the circulating current losses. It's not possible to generalize, but that's the way the data seems to run. But here, in this particular slide, we have three loaded ducts, which means we're in this range of sizes. You see, we only have 1 million to 1.5 million here, where we couldn't fit the three cables in 1 5-inch duct, and we didn't feel that we felt most utilities are somewhat limited on duct size, so we printed these out for single conductor cable per duct. Notice in that kind of a setup, recognizing if we have an open circuit, in other words, single point grounding, no circulating current losses, for 1500 we'd get 792 amps, and for 1500 with a 1/3 neutral we have 520. That's quite a reduction. Notice on the earth interface temperatures that when you're in duct, at least with one circuit, don't seem to, the interface temperatures are well within what might be considered acceptable values, if such a connotation could be applied. This one is printed out to 50 degrees C, and on that basis, we did have some derating. It was about 534, 494, so the third ampacity is lower because we told the computer that 54C is too high. What would it be if we held it at 50C? Can I have the next slide, please? Here's a case where we had the smaller conductor sizes, and we can get three in a duct. So we printed out on that basis. Again, our earth interface temperatures, the second column, relatively low. Our D rating due to circulating current losses are okay. This conductor sizes are relatively small, and we have three in the duct, so our circulating current losses are not too bad. We have another, next slide, please. Here's a comparison data. This first setup here, pick that up a little bit. And this first, here we have the ampacity reduction due to short-circuited shields versus open-circuited shields. In other words, this gives you the full effect of the circulating current losses. And this is at a row of 90 load factor. Notice small size, 1, 2%, 6%. At the bottom, we're talking about 28%, 30%. For 750, we're talking about the 13%, 18%. This is the reduction in ampacity as for circulating current losses as compared to if the circulating current losses didn't exist. And on the right, you have the triplex cables, and the percent reductions are significantly less as we would expect. And this, I think, is an interesting comparison. We have the next one, please. Now here we have a curve which basically takes all the data that we printed out and just divides it, and it's interesting percentages. Here is we have a maximum interface temperature of 50 degrees C, or interface temperature of 50 degrees C. This gives you the percent reduction in ampacity if we're interface temperature limited versus conductor temperature limited. Notice we're up around 32%, 29%, and on the right-hand side, where we're talking about where we have a 60 degree C interface, so the reductions are seem to peak out around 20% as compared to 32% for the 50 degree C limited. Have the lights, please. In conclusion, I'd like to just summarize some of this information. Circulating current losses may exert a marked influence on the opacity of single conductor cables with bonded and grounded shields or concentric conductors. By the way, all the calculations were done for concentric conductors, but they apply pretty much for shielded and jacketed cables, where your shields are designed to carry significant fault currents. The only real errors that exist would be that the jacket, the effect of the thermal resistance of the jacket, which I think is very, very small, and possible inclusion of eddy current losses in the shields if they consist of a metallic tape. The influence of the losses depends on the size of the insulated conductor, size of the neutral, spacing of the cables. Circulating currents increase and opacities are reduced as cable spacing increases. This is for normal direct earth buried or duct spacings. It doesn't apply to some of the cases where you may really space the cables out quite a bit. For given insulated conductor size, circulating currents increase or decrease depending upon the relative values of concentric conductor resistance and mutual reactance. The maximum circulating current occurs where the concentric conductor resistance equals the mutual reactance. This is not necessarily the largest concentric conductor size. Circulating currents increase as the size of the insulated conductor increases. For direct buried cables, ratings based on limiting cable earth interface temperatures to 50 or 60 degrees C in most cases results in significant reduction in opacity as compared with ratings based on a maximum conductor temperature. For cables in duct, limiting the duct earth interface temperature to 50 or 60 degrees C does not have a significant effect on opacity, at least for the case of a single circuit in a duct bank. It would if you start talking about multiple circuits in a duct bank, then your interface temperature again would be involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dave. And now to our anchor man of the afternoon. I'll just say here that there will be a short intermission after our next presentation. I hope that we don't lose all of you. We intend to have a discussion period after that. But now to bring us the experience of the Central Electricity Generating Board in their operation of direct buried cables is Mr. Don Skipper.
Well, Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, may I say first of all how much I appreciate the opportunity of being here to join in this discussion this afternoon. But perhaps I could say that should you wish to ask me again, perhaps you could make it at a rather warmer time of the year. Well, my allotted task is to try to briefly review British current rating practice and particularly how account is taken of problems of moisture migration and soil drying effects. And in doing this, I propose to deal with the subject in two parts, beginning with the higher voltage end, the transmission cables, 132 kV and above, and secondly, dealing with distribution cables, which in our terms means cables to operate at voltages of 33 kV and below. I think this distinction is necessary because clearly with the higher voltage, more expensive cables, perhaps one can afford to use rather more sophisticated methods of avoiding these dangers than with lower voltage cables. But before I start, could I just make two general remarks that all I'm going to say refers to self-contained cables directly buried at depths of about 3 to 4 feet below the ground surface. And the second general point relates to the units used for thermal resistivity. We are, as you know, going metric, and this involves getting used to many new and strange units. And you'll notice, therefore, that on the slides, thermal resistivity is expressed in degrees centigrade meter per watt, but I'm afraid that old habits die hard, and you'll probably find me constantly referring to degrees centigrade centimeters per watt. Well, having said that, perhaps we could start off with a few remarks about the high voltage end, In other words, pressure-assisted cables for transmission purposes. Now, up until about 8 or 9 years ago, the practice was very simple, and that was to assign an all-year-round rating based upon a maximum conductor temperature of 85 degrees centigrade, a soil thermal resistivity of 120 degrees centigrade, centimeter per watt, and a ground ambient temperature of 15 degrees centigrade. So 85 degrees centigrade, 120 degrees centigrade, centimeter per watt, 15 degrees centigrade for the ambient ground temperature. Now, this simple approach had to be modified, and modified fairly quickly, when in July 1962, two breakdowns occurred in quite rapid succession due to thermal instability on a double circuit 132 kV feeder in South London. This was being used, in effect, to bring power from a generating station on the Thames to a point in South London, and had in fact been carrying sustained loadings at or near its maximum rating for extended periods during a spring and summer which had been relatively dry. Now this experience focused attention rather forcibly on this problem of moisture migration, and it was decided as a first measure, and here I must apologize to Les Fink, but it was decided that we should impose a limiting cable surface temperature of 50 degrees centigrade, except during a period from mid-November to March, when it was judged that the problem of the risk of moisture migration was quite negligible. Now, applying this condition of a limiting surface temperature of 50 meant that the summer rating, and by summer one means here the period which is not winter, the summer rating of cable circuits was significantly lower, and in general something like 20% lower than the winter rating. Now, since in Britain our maximum system demand occurs during the winter, this was no enormous handicap, at least not while we continue to use the same set of environmental parameters all the year round. However, some 3 to 4 years ago, it was decided to take advantage of the fact that during the winter months, soil conditions are more favorable for heat dissipation. The moisture content is, of course, usually greater because the water table is somewhat higher, and the factors leading to evaporation, of course, are not really so active at that time of the year. Now, if I could have the first slide, please. This shows, in tabular form, the values of the relevant parameters. And as you can see, it was decided to use for this winter period values of soil thermal resistivity of 105 and a ground ambient of 10 degrees centigrade, which had the effect of increasing the winter capability by something approaching 10%. Now, this, of course, now comparing this with the summer rating on which we've applied this sheath limiting temperature of 50, meant that the disparity between the two ratings was now made rather large, and greatly increased the number of cases in which the required summer rating dictated the cable design, that is, the cable conductor size and the phase spacing required. So, in other words, it meant that there were very few cases in which, having written down the values of environmental parameters for winter, we could really make use of them. And it was to overcome this disadvantage that special backfills were introduced, so that the maximum allowable temperature of 85 degrees centigrade could be used all the year round. And for this purpose, various compounded backfill materials, which have been designated stabilized backfills, have been developed and utilized. Now, the fundamental thermal property required of a stabilized backfill is that when adequately compacted in a cable trench, its thermal resistivity does not exceed 120 degrees centigrade centimeter per watt when completely dried out. Now, if I could have slide two, please, and we can go on to talk about methods of use of these special backfills. First of all, if I may draw your attention to the left-hand side, this is really the simplest method of use. in which sufficient backfill is placed in the trench to completely contain the 50 degree centigrade isotherm. Now, this means, of course, that none of the indigenous soil is subjected to a temperature above 50, and therefore none is considered to have dried out. But it can be seen that this has the practical disadvantage that it requires more backfill below the cables than above, and often involves, of course, excavating a deeper trench than would otherwise be necessary. And it is to overcome this rather serious practical disadvantage that the second method of use, which is shown on the right-hand side, has been adopted. Now, in this case, as you see, only a limited amount of backfill is placed below, which means that within the 50-degree isotherm, one has zones of soil which are considered to have dried out, because clearly within those regions the temperature exceeds 50. Now, in this particular example shown here, it's been possible to just slightly increase the phase separation between the cables to compensate. So one has reduced the mutual heating between phases, and this compensates for the increased total resistance due to these regions of high resistivity dried out soil. But I think one can see the advantage. In this particular example, one has reduced the depth of the trench to about 3/4 and the volume of backfill required to something less than half. So this other method has obvious economic advantages. So for these sort of reasons, there's been a move away from the application of a limiting cable surface temperature in an environment of uniform thermal resistivity to a concept which involves considering the environment to have a number of values of thermal resistivity, each individual value depending upon the component material and its position relative to the 50 degree isotherm. Now, Les Fink was reminding us that the complicated mechanism of soil drying, and that there's no such thing as a magical critical temperature. And this, of course, is absolutely true. I think he told us there's no need for me to repeat it. The rate of moisture migration depends upon many things. It depends upon the type of soil, the moisture content. And indeed, there's no critical temperature, because all it means is that as the temperature increases, the rate of moisture migration increases. But we have, and the other important thing, of course, is temperature gradient. Now, in fact, it has been observed from a number of field experiments that the limit of drying, the zone of dried out soil, follows far more closely lines of equal temperature gradient than lines of equal temperature, namely isotherms. Now, whereas, of course, an isotherm tends to go deeper below the cables than above, for a line of equal temperature gradient, it would be precisely the reverse. One would, of course, have it going a greater distance above than below. And so the application of such a principle would come near to this sort of system for different reasons, which has the practical advantages I've mentioned. But nevertheless, I think it is felt that the complication in the computation is hardly justified in this instance. So I'm afraid for practical purposes we are, in fact, still working to the idea of a limiting critical temperature. I hope that's sufficient apologia to Les Fink. Perhaps I should mention at this stage the three types of stabilized backfill which are available and in use in Great Britain to give you an idea of the sort of material which we're talking about in this context. First of all, there's a cement-bound sand, with sand and cement in proportions of approximately 14 to 1 by volume. This, in order to give a maximum dried-out thermal resistivity of 120, needs to be compacted in the trench with a density not less than 1.6. And secondly, we've also used, and fairly extensively, a sand-gravel mix consisting of roughly equal proportions by volume of sand and shingle or gravel. This requires to be compacted with a minimum density of 1.8 in order to meet the desired thermal resistivity condition. And thirdly, a bitumen bound sand, selected sand to which has been added about 6% by weight of bitumen, and this requires to have a critical density of about 1.4. That's to give one a very brief idea of the sort of materials which have been used in this application. Now, it will be appreciated, obviously, that since these stabilized backfills need to be specially compounded, their cost is inevitably greater, several times greater, in fact, than that of a normal bedding sand. And therefore, the extent to which naturally occurring sands could be used for this purpose has been examined. Now, a survey has been made of the thermal properties of a large number of the sands in Great Britain. And I think if I could have slide 3 now, please. This, in fact, shows the general relationship between dry thermal resistivity and density. The density, of course, in each case being achieved with a specified compactive effort, related to that, of course, which you'd expect to get in a cable trench. Now, the two lines show the spread of results, which is to be expected, since thermal resistivity is a function of other things besides density. Now, in fact, there has been some selection to get even within these limits, in that only sands with good cohesive properties have been eliminated. Now, we must define what we mean by good cohesive properties. This is really a measure of, well, as its name implies, of the cohesion, or really the crushing strength of a sand, which is a useful rapid measurement or an indication of the particle size distribution. It means that one has a reasonably good particle size distribution, the sort of thing that Les Fink was talking about, not a uniform grain size sand. So that one has done some selection in these terms in order to get sands within these limits. Now, the point is, of course, to be of much general use, I think these must be of reasonably good availability. Now, in fact, we find if one talks about sands which have a 50% availability, then we're on a point on the graph here with a density in the trench of 1.45, and if one takes the upper limit, this is corresponding to a thermal resistivity of somewhere in the region of 250. Now, I think you'll appreciate that this is rather high to be of much benefit in practice, and so these naturally occurring sands have found very little application so far for use as special backfills. In other words, where you've got a situation where you cannot justify the use of a compounded stabilized backfill, then one merely operates the limitation of a cable surface temperature of 50 degrees centigrade using a bedding sand for which no specific thermal properties are laid down. Well, so much for supertension cables, transmission cables, and perhaps I can now move on to lower voltage cables. Now here, of course, in general, individual computation of current ratings along the lines which you can imagine are involved for the sort of things I've been talking about are no longer justified, and it is more appropriate, of course, to rely upon tabulated values. Now, as I mentioned before, we've been going metric, and in calculating and tabulating ratings for metric designs of cable, certain important changes have been introduced which are relevant in the context we're talking about this afternoon. Now, as before, these current ratings are tabulated for the various types of cable for standard environmental conditions. That is, for bedded cables, as I've indicated, a soil thermal resistivity of 120, and an ambient ground temperature of 15 degrees centigrade, and appropriate rating factors are given for departures from these standard conditions, including variations in soil thermal resistivity. Now, the new feature in all this is to give recommended values of thermal resistivity to be applied in practice, which depend not only upon the type of soil in which the cable is to be bedded, but also on the nature of the load pattern to which the cable is likely to be subjected. Now, both these factors obviously have an important influence on the risk of soil drying out. And what has been done, in effect, is to estimate the probable extent of soil drying for each of these conditions, that is, combinations of type of soil and type of load pattern, then to assume a soil thermal resistivity of 300 in the dried out condition, and a value appropriate to the moist soil outside that zone, in order to derive an overall effective value of soil thermal resistivity. Now, perhaps if I can have the next slide, I can give just an example of what this involves. And I should explain. Should we have it up just a time? That's fine. This is just an example. It's my own extract from an ERA report, which covers this subject in much more detail. Now, the first thing I think to point out is you see there are three types of load specified as A, B, and C. And broadly, I think these can be defined as follows. Type A is a sustained or cyclic load, which is more or less of constant value throughout the year. Now, this is the most onerous type because of the likelihood that continuous heating will at some time coincide with extended periods of dry weather in summer. Now, then moving on to type B, this is again a load which varies throughout the year but could possibly attain a maximum value during some summers. So on a simple probability basis, this is rather less onerous than type A. And then finally, C, which is the least onerous, represents a load pattern which has a pronounced maximum during winter months. Now, it can be seen that for each type of soil, clearly the value of G taken decreases as the type of load pattern becomes less onerous. I think perhaps also the line entitled Under Impermeable Cover requires a little explanation. This in fact applies to what I've lumped together here as normal soils when these are under coverings such as tarmac or concrete or something similar on the ground. Now, such coverings prevent, of course, evaporation and so help to maintain a higher soil moisture content than would otherwise obtain. And because of this, of course, values of G under these conditions can be reduced, and in fact by something between 20 and 25%, as you see. And the third point, perhaps, is that for the types A and B, these rather onerous load patterns, which tend to have a maximum in the summer, and if one is dealing with a well-drained sand or a made-up soil, one is getting, of course, values of G of a very high order, but up to 250. And in these cases, it is often advantageous, I would imagine, to import backfill to replace these soils rather than put up with such high values, especially, of course, if one is dealing with rather large conductor sections. Well, I think my time is probably up, Bill. Well, I hope that in what I've been able to say, that I've given you some idea of British practice, and hope that at least some of the things I've said may possibly prove to be of some value in formulating your own procedures. Thank you very much. Thanks.